Blog Talk Radio
presents a Blog Radio Show.
Everybody, welcome to Applause Radio Show. I hope everybody's doing well. Happy Sunday. Tomorrow, you blinked your eyes, didn't you? Because tomorrow is Monday. We are back in the sack where we're going to be working again tomorrow. So anyway, I hope everybody had a great weekend. A little chilly here on the East Coast. I was just talking to Howard about that. And before we start, I can't even say. I am honored to have this gentleman join us tonight. I don't even know. I'm definitely not in the same league as this gentleman. I mean, he is a genius, and I am far from that. So without further ado, I welcome author, scientist, Mr. Howard Bloom. How are you, sir? Welcome to the show.
Joanne, it's a pleasure to meet you. And I'm sorry it was so cold today out there.
Oh, that Mother Nature, she's such a bitch. I can't stand her.
Yes, and the crocuses are out, and the daffodils are out. So all of the plants are under the impression that it's spring, and today's weather must have clobbered them. I'm sure they're built to handle it.
Well, I must have been a daffodil today because I had the shock of my life. It was so cold. My son had a rugby game, and it was freezing.
You had to sit out there for an hour and a half, Joanne?
Oh, God, no. I was in the car, honey, with the seats. I couldn't do it. With the hot warmers on the seats, it was too much for me. It just kills my body, too. It was so painful. It was horrible. But, it was a horrible day. Horrible day. Weather. For me, when I say horrible, I just mean for me personally, body-wise. You know, my aches and pains these days, it's just horrible. But, Howard, I don't know if I could keep up with you on our show tonight. I mean, my goodness, I'm speaking to a scientist here who is compared to Darwin, Einstein. I mean, my goodness. So what do I owe this pleasure?
Well, my publicist, with whom you are apparently friends. So,
yes, my lead.
And I was looking forward to this. So what's your background, Joanne? How did you get into all of this?
Well, I am just having a lot of fun, Howard. I was a singer. Well, I don't know if you'd still call me a singer, singer-songwriter, definitely still a songwriter. And I had a bout with 9/11, and I kind of lost my singing voice, and I wanted to stay in the entertainment industry, and I just wanted to help people. And, no matter what people need to get out there, promote something or anything, I'm here for them. You know, that's it, just having a great time and enjoying meeting you wonderful people along the way.
Well, that sounds terrific. And I got plunged into all of this madness at the age of 10 when I was a total reject in my hometown of Buffalo, New York. Not a single soul wanted to have anything to do with me, including my parents, who had absolutely no interest. Well, they treated me as if I were an inanimate object. And I discovered books. And I discovered science, and I found this book that said the first two rules of science are these: the truth at any price, including the price of your life. And it gave the example of Galileo, and it said that he would have gladly gone to the stake and been burned alive in order to defend his truth, which didn't turn out to be true, Joanne, but that would take me 30 years to find out. And it's the second rule of science, it said, was look at things right under your noses if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. And it gave the example of Anton von Leeuwenhoek, the guy who invented the microscope and looked at a drop of pond water and discovered that we had been sharing this planet the whole time we were here with this invisible world of what he called animalcules, tiny little beasts, protozoans and bacteria. And what the book didn't tell me was that von Leeuwenhoek, the second rule of science is the rule of courage, or the first rule is the law of courage, and second is the rule of wonder and awe. Von Leeuwenhoek had looked at a drop of fresh sperm under his microscope and then sent a report on it to the Royal Society. And, of course, he discovered that it was filled with tiny little animalcules with long tails propelling themselves around. And it took me about 20 years to realize what was his source of fresh sperm. In other words, Anton von Leeuwenhoek had had the courage, and this really does take balls in every sense of the word, to masturbate, look at the product under the microscope, then declare his secret shame, his masturbation, to the Royal Society.
Oh, my God. You're right.
In the name of curiosity and the name of science. Now, if that doesn't take gumption, if that doesn't take courage and strength of will, nothing does.
No, so, you're right. I mean, like you said, this guy who's just sitting there is like, I wonder what's in there.
Right. So there I had these two exemplars when I was 10 years old. As I said, nobody in my hometown wanted to have anything to do with me. So I had two guys I could hang out with now, Joanne, who would not say no to me. I mean, the kids in Buffalo, my hometown, had literally one day when they saw me coming toward a baseball game they were about to set up, where they were about to choose sides, had literally picked up their bat and balls and found another field in order to avoid me. And these were two guys who couldn't do that for a very simple reason. They were dead. So I started reading two books a day, science fiction, whatever I could get my hands on. I mean, I read through the librarians a few blocks away from me were extremely kind to me. And the books I wanted to read were not for children. They were not allowed to let me read them. And they didn't care. They let this 10-year-old into the back of their stacks to dig out as many adult books as I wanted. And
goodness they did.
Yeah, I mean, they were more like mothers to me than my mother in that sense. They took good care of me. They took care of the care and feeding of my brain. And two books a day is a substantial number of books over the course of time.
You would read two books per day, cover to cover.
Yes, I would read one under the school desk. My teachers hated me. I mean, you know, teachers are normal human beings. They need attention. And I was giving them absolutely none. I was totally absorbed in my book. And then I'd read another when I got home at night. I don't know how I did it. It takes me 3 weeks to read a book now. A little busier than I was back then.
Right.
So I started in microbiology and theoretical physics when I was 10 years old. And then I piled up my first scientific credentials when I was 12. I co-designed a computer that won some science fair awards. I built the first and only Boolean algebra machine, a symbolic logic machine. And I was schlepped off to a meeting with the head of the graduate physics department at the University of Buffalo, my local university. And I would imagine, Joanne, you want to get your kid who's 12 years old in with the head, not just of the physics department, of the graduate physics department, who deals with 22-year-olds. How do you do it? Well, you pull a lot of strings. You twist a lot of arms. So I would imagine this guy had blocked off 5 minutes of courtesy time for me. And I didn't emerge from his office until over an hour later. Why?
Wow.
Because it was 1955. The hottest topic in science at the time was Big Bang versus steady state theory of the beginning of the universe. And we spent an hour talking about the interpretation of the Doppler shift and its implications for Big Bang versus steady state theory. And when we came out of his office, he put his hand on my shoulder. He towered above me. And doesn't take much to tower above me. Frogs can tower above me.
Me too.
and he said, you don't have to save for grad school for him. He'll get fellowships at any grad school he wants in theoretical physics. So, and my mom, sometimes she paid attention to me. My mom, though she didn't have direct contact with me, she found somebody who was the head of research and development for a company called the Moog Valve Corporation. Sounds like it's involved with making plumbing, right? And she got him to tutor me in outside-the-box science. Well, decades later, I would discover that the Moog Valve Company made the valves for the jet engines that broke the sound barrier. And right. The jet engines that first took humans to the edge of space, the Bell X, spaceships is what I'm tempted to call them. They were rocket planes and jet planes. So this guy was on the cutting edge, and he's tutoring me personally, spending an hour of his time a week. I mean, give me a break. And then when I was 16, I was given a job as an assistant for the summer at the Roswell Park Memorial Cancer Research Institute, which was the biggest cancer research institute in the world. And I was allegedly doing work on cutting-edge work on the immune system. But frankly, Joanne, the immune system didn't interest me. What interested me was something called the CPT problem in theoretical physics. If matter and antimatter are created in equal amounts, then where's all the antimatter? They're created in equal amounts at the very same time. Where is all that stuff? And right, so I came up with something called, originally called the Bloom Toroidal Model of the Universe, more colloquially known as the Bloom Big Bagel theory of the universe. That was the theory of the beginning, middle, and end of the universe. And in 1959, it predicted something that wouldn't be discovered until 1998 called dark energy, and it explains dark energy. And there's a simple animation on YouTube about it. You just look up Howard Bloom Big Bang or Howard Bloom Big Bagel, and it's had close to 1 million hits so far.
So
that's my background in science, which explains easily why I got involved with Michael Jackson, Prince, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, AC/DC, Aerosmith, Kiss, Queen, Run-DMC, Billy Joel, Paul Simon, Billy Idol, it's obvious.
Yeah, really, right. Hello. I got to ask you all these things you were saying. My heart breaks for you that you were so lonely as a child, but yet you found,
it
you know, within
benefit,
the book.
Joanne. I couldn't have asked for anything better. It hurt.
Exactly.
It hurt, but it was a benefit.
Right. That's what I'm saying. My heart breaks for you for your childhood, yet you found something that you loved, and look at where you are now. I got to ask you, do you think that had you been a child to stupid question, because at the time there wasn't many people who had what you had. So for you to have that genius in you at a young age during the 50s, do you think that if you were like that now as a child, it would be such a big deal?
I guess it wouldn't be such a big deal because I'd have the internet. And on the internet, I could find other people like me, whether they were in Lima, Peru, the Bronx. I mean, I used to read about Isaac Asimov, whose books I was reading, and his friends at the Bronx High School of Science. And how I longed for a Bronx High School of Science. But there was none. And Joanne, that was a tremendous benefit to me. I mean, one day I was working at one of the cafes where I've written most of my books. And there was a reasonably attractive woman in her 50s. And after I'd had 3 hours of solid work and needed a break, I started a conversation with her. And she turned out to be the digital editor for the Oxford or Cambridge University Press. And she threw a question at me I'd never been asked before. And she said, what field is your training in? And I suddenly realized I had the enormous benefit of never having any training. In other words, nobody stood over me and made me a carbon copy of his or herself.
Right.
And so my utter isolation turns out to be a tremendous benefit because it allows me to be an outsider and see things that other people can't see. And I've been published in scholarly journals or given lectures at scholarly conferences in 12 different scientific fields. If somebody had pummeled me into thinking exactly the way he thought and doing things exactly the way he did them in grad school, I would never have had this privilege.
Right, right. Did you have the opportunity to work with NASA by any chance?
Back in 2005, a bunch of people leaned on me really heavily to go to a space conference for the first time. Mm-hmm. I'd been into space since I was 10 years old, and I didn't want to go. And I explained to them that I only go to conferences where I'm speaking, because I get very depressed just being lost in the crowd with no one having a clue as to who I am. And the people who were pummeling me into this were a senior risk analyst from NASA, a person from the National Science Foundation, which is the Vatican of science, and people from the National Space Society. And they finally made me a deal. They said, look, there's a guy who has the space show. He hears you on Coast to Coast. Coast to Coast is the highest rated overnight talk radio show in North America. Art Bell was its founder, and I've been appearing on Coast to Coast. Now I appear every Wednesday night, but I've been appearing on Coast to Coast for something like 25 years.
Hmm.
And they said, look, the guy who runs the space show knows absolutely everybody in the space industry, everybody of any importance he has interviewed. He is a huge fan of your work on Coast to Coast. We will assign him to you as a babysitter. And he will make sure that you meet everybody of any importance whatsoever, and you certainly will not feel lost in the crowd. And I, said the person who was putting this deal together, the senior risk analyst from NASA, will fly up from Texas to be with you. So they did, and I've been in space ever since. At that mm-hmm. conference, I ran into Buzz Aldrin. I didn't just run into Buzz Aldrin. I formed a tag team with my NASA friend, and when there were people of importance we really wanted to meet, he would run down one aisle, and I would run down another aisle when people were getting up out of their seats when the affair was over. And I saw Buzz Aldrin, and we tag-teamed Buzz Aldrin. And Buzz Aldrin convinced me to start something called the Space Development Steering Committee, which I've been running for the last 17 years. And Buzz became a friend. We used to talk on a regular basis. Then I think I offended him 3 years ago at Maxwell Air Force Base. I came up with a simple moon plan, $2 billion moon plan, or a moon prize. To use off-the-shelf technology to get us to the moon fast. And that project made it into Time Magazine, made it into Newsweek, but it was a moon program. And Buzz called me twice one afternoon. I happened to be I seldom go to parties. I don't have time for them. I don't really know what it is to party. A party's just a useful forum for me to meet a lot of people I haven't said hello to in a long time. Mm-hmm. And there was a party of the people who used to be my staff at the Howard Bloom Organization, the PR firm that I founded that became the biggest PR firm in the music industry. And I hadn't seen these people in 30 years or something like that. So I went into town to see them. And I was standing in the middle of a bunch of people who used to be my staff talking to them, and the phone rang, the phone on your hip. And I picked it up. It was Buzz Aldrin. Well, and he called twice that afternoon. They must have thought this was a setup. I mean, you never know who's on the other end of the phone. The person talking to you could claim anybody was on the phone. He could claim Albert Einstein was calling you, coming back from the dead, and nobody would know.
Right.
So I am certain they thought I was conning them, that it couldn't possibly really be Buzz Aldrin
right.
on the phone. But, you know, how many people have had the privilege of working with people like Billy Joel, Paul Simon, Peter Gabriel, Buzz Aldrin, Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth man on the moon, who used to give me enormous moral support when I would run into problems? I mean, you know, sometimes people can descend on you and try to kick you around, and you have to stand up to them, and it takes heart. And Edgar used to give me heart. These things are just in the right. And how many people can be published in 12 different scientific fields? Publish or give lectures in 12 different scientific fields.
I know.
So let me ask you, wait.
I don't know. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry, Howard. I've got so many questions for you because your life is amazing. And I want to touch on a few things when you were telling me about your childhood. Again, have you ever watched that show Sheldon, and do you relate to him in any way?
I've never seen it. What is it?
He's about a young boy who's a genius in a small town, and, you know, they think he's an odd kid, and, you know, he winds up being actually, the show earlier, The Big Bang Theory. Did you ever watch that? Well,
right.
he's supposed to be Sheldon as a child.
I tried to watch it twice, but, you know, there was no category for a kid like me. There was no name for a kid like me. There was no nothing. There was no support mechanism except in books. And that's probably why I read two books a day, because that was a refuge. That was a place where I could find what seemed to be other people. One of the things I realized, you know, I got sick in 1988 and spent 15 years in bed. And the only way I survived was by fashioning a whole new, it's not a new personality, it's entering a whole new realm and establishing whatever it is there, a presence. And that whole new realm was the internet. And the internet, of course, was very new in 1988 to 1991 when I was doing these things. But then I realized I've been living in virtual worlds my whole, if you'll excuse the language, fucking life. From the time I was 10, what did I enter in books? A virtual world. So virtual worlds are perfectly normal to me, and were at a time when people had never encountered a virtual world, when there was no such thing as a browser, when there was no such thing as the World Wide Web. But still, there was the darkness of the virtual digital domain. And thank God, it gave me a place where I could survive.
Now, I got to ask you now, I apologize, I don't know much about this book, about how I accidentally started the 60s. Is it about more of the music or just the 60s in general?
It's not about
shy
the music
guy, I'm picturing you were a very shy guy growing up, like, you know, as a guy.
I was, and social incompetence.
So tell us about, how did you accidentally start the 60s?
Well, I somehow, in addition to the books, I got into reading Time magazine from cover to cover every single week. I had a best friend. I was lucky. And my best friend and I used to win the Time magazine contest that the high school threw every year. And in Time magazine, they covered in every single issue this oddball group. It gave them an excuse to put sex in Time magazine called the Beatniks. And I, living in an imaginary world, having never met a beatnik in my life, thought that if I could ever meet the beatniks, that was a group that would accept me. And then my father made a huge mistake. He loved to take us on vacations. And one year, instead of putting us in the car and driving us to Mexico or to Florida or something like that, he got us a cottage on Cape Cod in Provincetown. And I was walking down the street in Provincetown. I saw an art gallery. It looked interesting. I walked in. The owner of the gallery was holding forth with four friends of hers. They were all in their 30s or 40s. And they invited me into the conversation, and they got so crazy about having me in the conversation that that's where I went every day. And these were authentic beatniks from New York City. The owner of the gallery lived on Bank Street in the heart of the legendary village, and Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
And I bought sandals, which, you know, outraged people in those days that you should wear sandals. And I started wearing them, and I wore them back to school. So I continued to have this. Not only now did I have Time magazine telling me about the meetings, I had been accepted at a reasonably high level as if I were an adult.
When I was
16 years old, in a beatnik community. So when I went off to college, I went to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, which later became famous as the place Steve Jobs dropped out of. And it had the highest median SATs of any school in the country, higher than Harvard, higher than Caltech, and higher than MIT the year that I was there. I don't know if that track record has maintained since then. And it was a very tough program, but I was interested, the beatniks were into Zen Buddhism, and I wanted to reach what's called enlightenment, partially because, Joanne, I was clinically depressed. I had been clinically depressed since I was a child. I was depressed every single waking second of the day, every day of the year. And I felt that if I were enlightened, it would remove this burden of emotional torture from me, emotional pain. And I got so serious about it that I started walking around barefoot. I let my hair grow. In those days, everybody had crew cuts, and your hair was a maximum of an inch long. Mm-hmm. And nobody had ever seen, first of all, no male had grown long hair before. The only place you saw long hair was on Jesus Christ, pictures of Jesus Christ. But in those pictures, his hair was straight. Well, it turned out, I didn't know this because I'd always worn a crew cut, but my hair was curly. And the only place people had seen anything like the curls growing out of my scalp were on the wigs that Harpo Marx used to wear. Mm. They'd never seen them for real on a real human being.
Right.
So my hair grew and I grew and I grew, and my feet grew very tough, and I became able to walk over gravel and ice and walk through snowstorms barefoot. And I was trying to find enlightenment, and I destroyed all of my normal life patterns because my impression of Zen Buddhism was that all of these things were escapes of some kind from the reality of that fresh little flickering blue light, like a pilot light in the soul. That's the source of your originality and your direct connection to God knows everything. And so I stopped my eating patterns because I felt they were escapes. I stopped my sleeping patterns because I thought they were escapes. I slept on the basement in the library. I slept at unpredictable hours. I ate at unpredictable hours because I was trying to get to that tiny little pilot light of spontaneity. And finally, a couple of other people said, why don't we all drop out of college together and continue this pursuit? And it was two people, somebody who'd graduated as a psychology major a few years earlier, but was still hanging around the campus and who looked like Adonis. He had the most gorgeous body you've ever seen. And this very, very pretty girl who was his girlfriend. And so I joined them, and she and I dropped out of college. He'd already graduated. And that started a series of adventures where I was looking for the beatniks. So we went up to Seattle, first of all, and then I hitchhiked from Seattle down to San Francisco, because San Francisco is where the beatniks were supposed to be.
Yep.
And they were supposed to be in a very specific neighborhood, and the capital of the beatniks was Lawrence Ferlinghetti's bookstore. Lawrence Ferlinghetti is this extraordinary poet, and he was the greatest poet, one of the two greatest poets of the beatnik age. So I went to the neighborhood in which the beatniks were supposed to be found, and I went to Ferlinghetti's bookstore, and I walked in, and the place was empty, and there was somebody behind the counter. And I said, but this place was supposed to be Beatnik Central. It was supposed to be crammed with beatniks, and there was nobody there. And I said, where are the beatniks? And he ignored me as if I didn't exist. So I walked out of Lawrence Ferlinghetti's bookstore looking as if I'd been smashed over the head with a hammer. And somebody, you really in these circumstances see how fundamentally kind people are under the surface. The book begins with the story of my being picked up by three murderers on my way to San Francisco. And how after two hours of trying to terrify me, they became concerned about me and started to try to save me. That just shows you even murderers care about other people. But one way or the other, this guy walked up to me and said, you look disturbed about something. Can I help you? And I said, yes, I'm looking for the beatniks. And he scrunched his eyes and he rolled the bump into his head and he scratched the top of his head. And he thought for a minute and a half. And then he said, have you tried Colorado? And that was a little too diffuse. A target for me. So what happened was that people started seeing me on this quest for enlightenment. And what I thought all I had were questions. They thought I had answers. They thought my questions were answers. And they started dropping out of their jobs and hitchhiking and riding the rails and following me. So I'm sure there are many others to whom this happened.
You know what, Howard, you know what I'm thinking? This may sound crazy, but are you telling me that the 60s really came about by people who were like you, like were geniuses and searching for a place to just fit in? And I mean, I know everybody had their reasons why they went off, but would you say the majority of during that time, hippies, beatniks were geniuses?
Well, first of all, it was 1961, so we still thought it was the 50s. The 60s hadn't yet gotten a name, and we would help the 60s get a name.
Right.
And the only other person that I met that gave me a key to this was I was hitchhiking near San Francisco, and this great big ancient pickup truck that looked in the dark, because it was night when he picked me up, like a giant pterodactyl, swung open its door, and I jumped in, and there was a guy and his girlfriend, and he was the leader of a commune, and he was a Marxist. So it was a deliberately Marxist commune. Now, how many people there were like him, I do not know. How many
I was
going to
ask you, before you said he was a Marxist, I was thinking it was Manson.
Right. No, it wasn't, fortunately. But I don't know how many people like me there were. I can be sure that it wasn't just me. I mean, the group that coagulated around me never amounted to more than about 10 people. But, you know, we were living at one point in a great big pink condemned house in Berkeley, three blocks from the college campus. And we were living naked. Why bother with clothes? So we didn't have clothes. We were just naked 24 hours a day. And it became so normal that when we needed to go to the grocery store to get food, it was very hard to remind ourselves that there was a world out there in which people frowned on nakedness and you must wear clothes to go to the grocery store.
What are your parents thinking this whole time you've been gone?
Well, okay, I don't know. I mean, they decided, because it was such a long distance and because the flights were so expensive, that they would skip Thanksgiving and they'd see me at Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, about a month before Christmas, I was in the cafeteria destroying my lifestyle at an odd hour. And I had taken my tray of food, and there were tables where there were people congregated, men congregated at some tables, girls congregated at others, and I didn't want to be with either of them. I don't like groups. And so there was one girl sitting alone at a table, so I went over and sat with her. And she was the most fascinating girl I probably ever met in my life. It turns out that she had hitchhiked, which is something that I'd read about in On the Road, you know, the Beatnik book by Jack Kerouac, but had never done. She claimed to be able to scale a three-story high brick wall from the outside, which she later demonstrated she could do easily. She claimed that she could climb any tree on campus, which she later demonstrated she could do quite easily. She was into the plays of Jean Ennui, and I was a French scholar at the time. I loved the French culture. And she could tell you the stories from these plays of Jean Ennui, and you would sit mesmerized at her feet. And she was gorgeous. So we were both very high-ranking students. We were serious about our studies, but we skipped every single class that afternoon because we were so fascinated with each other. We didn't part until about 9 o'clock at night. Now, Joanne, one thing you have to realize, when you're a schnook, a gunk like me, no girl wants to have anything to do with you, ever. So I had no history of dating, no history of feeling girls up, no history of petting, no history of any of the things that are normal in a kid's life.
Right.
And I'm 19. And I figured at the end of the evening, I'll never see her again. After all, she's beautiful. I'm not. And the next morning at 9 o'clock, she showed up at the entrance to the men's dormitory we were living in. And I heard this voice downstairs saying, "I think I left a notebook up there." So both of us missed every single class that day.
Mm.
And that's when she demonstrated that she could climb any tree. We spent most of the day outdoors. It was stormy. We felt that we were like King Lear, reeling against the storm, defying the storm.
Was there drugs involved in this, Howard?
What's that?
Was there drugs involved in this? Sounds like a shroom day.
No. There wasn't a single, not even coffee.
Not even coffee. It sounds like you got me picturing her scaling walls and climbing trees. I'm like, were they wasted?
No, we were so sober. We were high on each other. It was as simple as that. Then she showed me how she could scale the wall to reach her third story dormitory room. And she snuck me into the dorm. And I slept overnight with her. No, I didn't, you know, I had no sexual experience, none.
Right.
I didn't
right.
try anything sexual at all. I was simply following her lead on things. And her roommate was in the room next door, and the roommate was a very pretty girl I dropped out of school with. And her roommate had her boyfriend there, and the boyfriend was the guy who had graduated in philosophy a couple of years earlier, the one with the gorgeous body.
Right.
And I heard these horrible moans coming from the next room. And I thought, oh, my God, her Jimsy's roommate is being murdered. And I've been raised, if people are in trouble, you go there immediately and stop whatever the problem is.
Right.
You help. And yet Jimsy showed no alarm. Jimsy was the name of this astonishing woman. Jimsy showed no alarm about this. And so I lay there. And my arm felt eventually like they'd have to amputate it in the morning because I dared not move it from under her head. I'd never had a girl sleeping with her head on me before, even if there's nothing sexual going on. And the next morning, she took me out to the hallway. Again, remember, she was on the third floor, and this is a three-story building. It's a building that had seven dormitories. It was a giant building that had been partitioned into seven dormitories, four for men, three for women. And she showed me that the ceiling had a trap door.
Mm-hmm.
And if I climbed into that trap door, I'd be in an attic. Now, the attic had no floor, but there were boards set up so that electricians or roofers could come in and walk from one end of the building to the other if they were very, very careful. It was a bit like walking a tightrope. But it was set up so that you could transport yourself up there. And I crawled all the way to my dormitory and emerged from the trap door next to my dormitory room. And so for the next 2 weeks, I was sleeping every night with Jimsy, with nothing sexual going on. I was snuck into the girls' dorms. That was so forbidden in those days for a man to be in the girls' dorms that it was beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jimsy said, "Look, I'm on the Christmas vacation. I'm renting a shack. And would you like to spend the Christmas vacation with me?" Well, you really think I'm going to be able to say no to an offer like that? So I had to call my parents and say I won't be coming home for Christmas. Well, my mother nearly had a heart attack. My father nearly had a cerebral hemorrhage. I mean, they were looking forward so much to seeing me for Christmas that it was beyond belief. And I don't think I explained to them why I wasn't coming home for Christmas, because this kind of thing was frowned upon in those days, a man and a boy and a girl living together who hadn't been married. And meantime, for months, my roommates had been working on something. I had three roommates. And because I was an outsider, even in my own dorm room, they hit it. Every time I showed up, they'd go quiet. And it was obviously we're conspiring on something. And the leader of my roommates was a guy who knew the lyrics to every single folk song that could play the guitar chords for every single folk song on planet Earth. He was a dropout from Caltech, who'd come to Reed College. And so here's this guy with enormous skills, and I don't have any of these skills whatsoever. And it turns out what they've been conspiring on was this. There was a Christmas ball every year. And Reed College kids, who normally wore the most informal kid clothes you could imagine, would get dressed up in tuxedos and gowns for this thing. It was the big event of the year. And my three roommates, had their eyes on the prettiest girl at Reed College. And they were conspiring to get my amazingly talented roommate to go to the Christmas ball with her.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I walked in and said, well, it looks like I'm living with Jimsy over the Christmas vacation. They gave me looks that could have killed.
Is Jimsy the girl they were conspiring to get to go to the dance?
Yes, exactly.
Ah,
exactly.
I figured.
The schlub, the schnook.
Wound up with Jimsy.
Yes, wound up with Jimsy for Christmas vacation. So and eventually, of course, we did have sex, and that was my introduction to sex. So I went directly from no dating, no petting, no nothing. No ever feeling up a group, none of them things that are normal, to living with a girl over the Christmas vacation and having sex with her.
That was a great Christmas present.
Yes,
Your whole life opened up. Your whole life opened up on Christmas.
And I keep looking for her on Google to see what has happened with her. She was, this story, none of it is normal. She, when she was 15 years old, started sleeping with men in their 40s. And her parents sort of ignored it. She did it on her parents' porch, and they sort of pretended they didn't know or something. And then she fell madly in love with the headmaster of her school, who was married and had a son who was older than she was. Now, imagine yourself being the headmaster of that school. You know that sexual activity with any of your students is completely inappropriate. What's more, it's illegal. It's called statutory rape if you have sex with one of your pupils.
Mm-hmm.
So he must have tried to resist her like a madman, but she got him. So when she finally left me, she left school about a month after this Christmas vacation, and she went and he left his family. He married her. He got a job as a professor at the University of Oregon in Eugene, and that's the last I heard of her. And I haven't been able to find her even with the assistance of Google. So there are, Joanne, the basic bottom line, the moral of this story is, if you are completely ejected from normal human society, it's painful as all hell. But it puts you in the most advantageous position you could possibly ever experience, because it sets you up for a life of adventure, whether that's intellectual adventure, emotional adventure, crowd phenomena adventure, holding the forces of history in your hands, which was what I was after when I jumped in to popular culture, because popular culture was a field I knew nothing about.
Right.
Popular culture was the culture of the kids who used to beat me up.
Mm-hmm.
It was the opposite of my culture.
Right.
When I graduated from NYU, I eventually went back to school after 3 years of adventuring. And the first year in each semester, I was humiliated. Now, remember, I was a kid who never paid attention in class when I was in grammar school, right? I was reading books. But now, for reasons I do not know, grades meant something to me. And I was humiliated two semesters in a row. I got four A's and a B. And that B to me was a humiliation. So I sort of picked apart the motivation of a teacher and realized something. I had been reading the textbooks and learning the stuff that was in the textbooks. That was a mistake. I had to read with equal avidity the notes from class, because what the teachers wanted was not that you knew the facts. That would only get you a B. They wanted you to parrot their opinions. And unless you could do that, you would never get an A. So I reversed the order of my priorities and started really studying what was in the class note, my own class notes. And from that point on, I got nothing but A's for 3 years straight. Not a single B, and an occasional A plus. So, which, you know, nobody gives. Well, I graduated. Remember the head of the graduate physics department at NYU, who told my parents, my mother, that she didn't need to save for grad school for me because I would get fellowships anywhere I wanted. Well, by now, my focus was on something that didn't have a name yet. It was on what now is called neuroscience, the connection between psychology and the way the brain works and the way the body works. Because in the way the brain and body works are emotions and all kinds of hidden selves. And I got fellowships at four different grad schools in this field I was going to have to piece together by myself. And then I had a sudden
realization. How old are you at this time? How old are you at this time, Howard?
Well, by now, remember, I missed out on 3 years of school, so I was probably 27 years old. I was behind everybody else.
I'm just trying
1968, I would have been 25.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this sudden realization. Now, sometimes your realizations start from your muscles and your emotions and gradually work their way up to your conscious brain. This is one of those. And it seemed to me that grad school would be Auschwitz for the mind, because I had been fascinated by the mystic experience since I was 12 years old. I had known in my synagogue in Buffalo, New York, which was set up like a Protestant church with hard wood pew after hard wood pew. And once you sidled your way into the center of one of these hardwood pews, you'd never get out.
Right.
Because you'd have to go past everybody's knees. And, you know, tucking in your knees is really not anatomically possible. I don't know how we ever do it. So there you were pinned in between hardwood boards. And you stood when the rabbi said, and you sat when the rabbi said, and you sang when the rabbi said. Where is the ecstatic dimension here? Where is the transcendental, the transcendent dimension here? It isn't there. And I knew, I don't know how, Joanne, but I knew that that dimension was primary in religion. Now, remember, I'm reading books about anthropology at the same time I'm reading everything else. And I'm reading about societies in which there's a vastly different emotional experience than what I'm seeing in my synagogue.
Right.
And pursuing that experience became primal for me when I was 12 years old. And how did it fit with all my sciences? It's the basic force of history. One thing we don't recognize about Adolf Hitler is he was evil. If he had been incinerated at birth, that would have been a great idea. But he was also a brilliant artist. He was an artist at working the ecstatic emotion in his fellow human beings, an art that nobody seemed to recognize the importance of. But remember, I was born in the year the Holocaust was invented, 1943.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing what Hitler had done that was something we can learn from and must learn from was very important to me. This is one of the advantages of being outside of every system.
Right.
You can see things that it's not part of the norm to see. And that was incredibly important to get to the heart of this.
Pardon me.
So I had an opportunity to go into popular culture, and that how I got that opportunity is a long story in itself. And I had two options. I could go to grad school and Auschwitz for the mind, or I could go into this field I knew absolutely nothing about, popular culture, and use it as a periscope position to see into the dark underbelly where new myths and movements are made, to see into the very core of the forces of history, which happen to be these ecstatic experiences.
mm-hmm.
that I'd been after since I was 12 years old. And I was married. I had gotten married just after my freshman year at NYU to a woman who was 5 years older than I was and had a 5-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. And my wife, you know, in a marital relationship, if your partner does not want you to do something, but they don't want to confess that they don't want you to do something, they will give you a signal sort of under the floorboards.
Right.
And the floorboard, the under the floorboard signal I got from my wife is, I'm tired of having grad students, or I'm tired of having students as husbands.
Hmm.
So now I have two options. I'm married to the only woman on earth who would ever marry me, at least in my opinion. She happens mm-hmm. to have been the prettiest girl in her hometown of Kingston, New York, but that's another matter. Mm-hmm. And I can go to grad school and lose her and lose my soul.
Right.
Lose what I'm passionate about. Lose what I need to learn about. Or I can, my mother and my father used to have these arguments. My mother was pro-credentials, being credentialed, mm-hmm. getting mm-hmm. a doctor, you know, an MD,
right,
getting
degree.
A law yeah. degree, or being an academic. And my father started a small liquor store that became the largest liquor, whatever it is, entrepot in Western New York State. And my father kept talking about the real world. But Anne, he has to have experience in the real world. My mother right. wouldn't accept that. So I chose the path of the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And I said goodbye to all of those fellowships. And I dove into this thing I knew absolutely nothing about, popular culture. And I eventually founded the biggest PR firm in the music industry, all because of seeking those ecstatic experiences, seeking experiences like enlightenment, and seeking to find how they become the engines of the forces of history.
Well, that's one of the biggest questions I have for you for this whole show is our conversation is, how did a scientist, genius, the number one PR company, who had no idea, I mean, your music, I would have to guess, was not in that area, your taste or whatever. I mean, I don't know. How did this all happen? You knew nothing about public relations.
Well, okay. One year, my junior year of college, I took poetry very seriously. I had been reading it since I was 14 years old and writing it since I was 14 years old. And to me, poetry is anthemic. And poetry speaks to those elements of the soul that produce ecstasies. Those elements of the soul that have no way of expressing themselves in normal human language.
Right.
And so poetry was excruciatingly important to me. So I took courses from the poet in residence at NYU. And in my junior year, he pulled me aside after class. And he said, I want you to be on the staff of the literary magazine. Well, Joanne, I hate literary magazines. They're boring. So I never showed up. And the next year, he must have asked me in my sophomore year. So my junior year, he said, look, Bloom, wait until everybody leaves the room, close the door, sit in that seat. And he pointed to the bawling out seat across his desk, and I knew I was in trouble. So I closed the door, I sat down, and he said, look, you, last year I asked you to be on the staff of the literary magazine. You never even showed up. This year, I'm telling you, you are the literary magazine. You are the editor of the literary magazine. You don't even have a faculty advisor. The minute you walk out that door, you're it. Now walk out that door. And I walked out, and this is only the second time in my life this has happened to me, but I looked as if I'd been hit over the head with a sledgehammer. And a kid walked up to me and said exactly what that guy in San Francisco had said to me. You look disturbed about something. Can I help you? I mean, Joanne, the kindness of humans is beyond belief. The cruelty is beyond belief, too. But it's the kindness that you build new worlds from, not the cruelty. At any rate, so he invited me down to a cup of coffee. Now, Joanne, I had not grown up around other kids. They wanted nothing to do with me. I didn't know normal human rituals, and it isn't only petting that I didn't know. I didn't have any idea of what let's have a cup of coffee meant. But I followed him meekly down to a coffee shop, and he ordered a cup of coffee, and I ordered a glass of water. And he said, he asked me one of the most important questions of my life, which is, if you could do anything you wanted to do with this magazine, what would it be? And I said, it would be a picture book. So I assembled a staff of artists, and I turned it into a literary and experimental graphics magazine, experimental art magazine. And we came out with our first issue. It was 12 by 12 inches in size. It was on paper of a kind you'd never seen anything printed on before. It was in four colors, and it was gorgeous. It was drop-dead gorgeous. And I got the message that the student activity committees wanted to see me. Now, Joanne, NYU is one of those wonderful schools where you don't have to be part of a university. You can be part of the city. So I didn't know what a student activities committee was, and I didn't know we had one. But I was given the address. I went to the meeting. I showed up on time, and they said, we love your literary magazine. We're doubling your budget for the second issue. How often in life does that happen?
You got to – I apologize for this. Don't take it as an insult by any means, because I'm more of an entertainment person, but your life sounds to me like Forrest Gump. I swear to God. You've got a Forrest Gump thing going here. Yeah.
Yes, exactly, except I'm there not by accident. I'm there by accident, but I'm on a mission. I have a sense of purpose.
So who was it? Who were you having coffee with? I can't imagine who it could possibly be.
Well, I don't know who I was having a cup of coffee with. It just, when you are in classes with 150 people in an amphitheater setup room, and you are having interesting conversations with the professor, other kids notice you who you have never really registered, who you've never seen before.
Right.
So you're a kind of a campus star. And I guess I had that kind of a stature, but one way or the other, now I have a crew, a staff, an art staff, right?
Right.
And one day I walk into the apartment on 10th Street and 2nd Avenue of my most astonishing artist, my most brilliant artist. And there's no furniture in the room. And there's a wall-to-wall carpet, and he, his wife, and his three-year-old child are on the carpet crying. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, well, our electricity is about to be shut off. Our phone is about to be shut off. Our furniture has all been repossessed, and we're about to be evicted from our apartment. And I, if you'll excuse the language, I said, but you're fucking brilliant. How could that possibly happen? If you give me the portfolio of your work, I will take it out for 2 weeks because it's the beginning of the summer vacation. I haven't committed myself to a job yet. And in 2 weeks, I'll get you enough work. Anybody who sees your work is going to give you money. And you'll be able to pay your rent, and then I can go about finding a summer job. Well, it didn't – by the end of the summer, I hadn't accomplished anything. And I'm obsessive compulsive. I cannot stop a project once I begin that project. And so, and all these other forces I'm talking about were working on me, and they were all impelling me to use this as a periscope position into this culture I knew nothing about, popular culture. Because I'm now going to all of the biggest advertising agencies in the business, all of the biggest magazines in the business, all of the biggest publishing companies in the business, and even to the television networks and radio networks. So I'm getting toward the center of things. So I call Columbia University and said, I have a back problem. I won't be coming this year, which goes against all of my rules. I don't lie ever at all, to the best of my ability. And I continued with the art studio. Now, 3 years later, I had built the art studio up to be one of the leading avant-garde commercial art studios on the East Coast. I was featured on the cover of Art Direction magazine. I created a new animation technique for NBC TV, and we did all of the advertising for ABC's 7 FM radio stations at a time when they were about to try something risky beyond belief. They were about to change from top 40 formats, which had proven themselves, to something new that had been cooked up on a college campus, the most hippie college in America, Bard College, called Progressive Radio, where you would let the DJ play anything he wanted. And if he wanted to play a whole album from beginning to end, he could. This was outrageous. They could lose a fortune on this. And we did all of the advertising for their transition, all the graphic materials, and they asked me to found an advertising agency to handle her account, and I didn't do it because I had absolutely no interest in time buying, in learning time buying. It bored me. So we accomplished all these things, and then there was a guy named Matty Simmons who had helped invent something new for American Express called the credit card. And he had made a small fortune, and now he wanted to be a publisher. And he came up with this idea. There was a magazine that these kids in Boston put out every year, once a year, that sold out on newsstands all over America in 2 hours. And he went to these kids and said, look, if instead of doing this thing once a year, you do this for me once a month, I will move you to New York City. I will give you gorgeous apartments. I will give you glittering salaries. I'll give you everything you need to attract absolutely any girl that interests you. Well, it's hard to turn down an offer like that. And so he started the magazine in Boston was Harvard, the Harvard Lampoon. And the new magazine was called the National Lampoon. And he gave it to me, gave it to my art studio, to art direct. And there was a guy, remember when my best artist and his wife and baby were all sitting on the rug crying? And I said, give me your portfolio and I will take it out and get you work. He said, no, if you take my portfolio out, you have to take out the portfolio of my best friend because we came to New York City together to found an art studio.
Right.
His best friend's work was nauseating. Absolutely nauseating. But I needed to save this guy from being thrown out of his apartment. So I said yes. Well, 3 years later, when we had this new client, the National Lampoon, which meant we were going to be getting a big fat check every single month, he talked to all the artists in the studio and told them that if they threw me out of the studio, they could all divvy up my share of the money and they'd all be much better off. What he was really aiming for, and he got me kicked out of the studio, what he was really aiming for was to take over the art direction of the National Lampoon, which he did. And remember, his work was nauseating. So they were fired after 7 issues of the National Lampoon, and my brilliant artists who had rejected me ended up dying of alcoholism and because they needed somebody who would give structure to their lives, which I had done. And without that, they were helpless babies again.
Right.
So, and I was busy trying to start a second art studio because half of my artists had left with me. And I was covering, and meantime, oh, God, there's another story, if you can handle this. So, and then I need to make a phone call to L.A. But, so the other story, which one was I going to tell you? At any rate, oh, yes, okay, so I'm 12 years old. Back to when I was 12 years old, and reading 2 books a day, science fiction or science. And one day, I'm in 8th grade, and a girl rolled her eyes in my direction, and that had never happened before. Then she made eye contact. That had never happened before. I didn't realize it, but nobody looked at me when I was a kid. And the girl behind this gaze said, I told my mother you understand the theory of relativity. Now, Joanne, I had very little going for me, to say the least, in those days. But the kids had called me the sickly scientist. And it wasn't their calling me that. The fact is that science was my life at this point.
Right,
and I would be humiliated to admit the truth, which is, no, I don't understand the theory of relativity. So as soon as school got out, I jumped on my bicycle. I pedaled to the library where the librarians had been so good to me, allowing me to read any book in the place. And I said, give me everything you've got on Einstein's theory of relativity. And they went rummaged through the stacks and they came out with 2 books. One was a great big fat book by Einstein and 2 collaborators. And the other was a little skinny book by Einstein himself. And mm-hmm. I had learned, I put them on my bicycle clamp. I pedaled home as fast as I could. I sat in my bedroom with my guinea pigs and my lab rats and my guppies. And these are the creatures with whom I grew up. And I started on the big fat book because I had learned that if you take the most difficult path available, you learn things you would never learn taking the easy path.
Right.
And even if you finish a book and think you don't understand a thing, by the time you finish, you've gotten something.
Mm-hmm.
So I started on the big fat book. And by 8 o'clock at night, approximately 5 hours later, I had only gotten 50 pages into the big fat book. And the big fat book was all mathematical equations with about 7 English words per page. And I have never understood mathematical equations in my life. Never.
Mm.
So it's 8 o'clock. I suddenly realize, oh my God, I'm only 50 pages into this book. I'm not at 10 o'clock tonight. My mom is going to put me to sleep. If I don't understand the theory of relativity by 10 o'clock tomorrow, I'm toast when I show up at school.
Right.
So I turn to the little skinny book. And at the beginning of the little skinny book was an introduction by Einstein, who had written the whole book himself, mm-hmm. in which it felt like he reached out through the pages, grabbed me by my shirt front, pulled my nose up to his, and said, "Schmuck, listen up. To be a genius, it is not enough to come up with a theory only 7 men in the world can understand. To be a genius, you have to be able to come up with that theory and then express it so clearly that anyone with a high school education and a reasonable degree of intelligence can understand it."
Right.
So that's my marching orders, Joanne.
Hmm.
This is how the only slot that's been left for me in life is as an original scientific thinker.
Okay, so now you're doing the National Lampoon, and then how do you break into...
Well, we're about to get back to that. So,
yeah.
So Einstein told me through the pages of a book, to be an original scientific thinker, you have to be a writer. And not just any writer, you have to be a delicious, really good, easily understandable writer. So that's my marching orders. So I started taking writing very seriously. And when I was in the middle of all of my adventures, leaving Reed College and accidentally starting the hippie movement, I got a job at one point with the head of the Middlesex County Mental Health Clinic in New Brunswick, New Jersey, writing up all of his conference reports and stuff like that. So that was my first paid job. And then I had this feeling, my next step is to be in magazines, because that's where you do the kind of easily understandable, delicious writing Einstein demanded of me when I was 12.
Right.
But I had no idea of how to get into it. And I'm writing ferociously. I'm writing every single day. But I was also co-designing my clothes with a designer who was down the street from us on 2nd Avenue in the East Village. And so one day I walked into an office of a new fashion magazine, an underground fashion magazine that's being bankrolled by Baron Woolman, the guy who bankrolled Rolling Stone.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Rags. And so I walked, it's in a garment district building in an industrial loft, and there's an industrial elevator. So I take the elevator up to their floor.
Uh-oh. You there?
Portfolio, expecting that the 3 women in the room, I'm going to open the portfolio, and they're going to ooh and ah over the pictures. And I never get that far. It's the minute I get out of the elevator, these 3 women's jaws drop. And they said, "Do you have more clothes like this?"
Hmm.
Susan Harris clothes that I designed myself or co-designed with Susan. And I said, "Yes, I have a whole closet of them. Why?" And they said, "Do you think you could write an article about your clothes?" Well, this is exactly what I've been looking for. This is what Einstein ordered me to do. So I wrote an article for them, and they made me a contributing editor, and I wrote 175 articles for them. And then another
again,
of their contributors, this is my spare time.
Again, you were at the right place at the right time.
Yes. And so I got up in the morning at 6 o'clock. I went naked to the typewriter. It was one of those big Remington 1940s typewriters where you had to hit each key with a sledgehammer to get it to move. And well, I see you're still into the
naked thing too. So go ahead.
Yes, and I worked until 8 o'clock in the morning. I put on my Susan Harris clothes. I went to the studio. I developed, you know, kept moving the studio ahead and up the hill. And then I came home and I'd sit in front of the Remington typewriter again till 11 o'clock at night and write. And then one of the other contributing editors to Rags Magazine started her own magazine called Natural Lifestyles. And she said, I need you as a contributing editor. So now I'm a contributing editor to two magazines. So I've just been thrown out of my own studio. And I'm covering a parapsychology convention one day. For Natural Lifestyles magazine. And I've got a pen in my right hand because I have no memory, Joanne. And so when interesting things happen, if I don't write them down immediately, there's no way I'll ever retrieve them from memory. My memory is a total washout. So a kid sees me scribbling madly on this pad and walks over and says, would you like to edit a magazine? Well, magazine writing is exactly what Albert Einstein is telling me I have to master.
Right.
Would I like to edit a magazine? That would mean I don't have to get up at 6 in the morning to write. I could write during the day.
Right.
For God's sakes. So, I said yes. And I didn't care what the magazine was because between my freshman year and sophomore year of college, the summer I got married, I had a summer job working for the Boy Scouts of America writing their guides on stalking and tracking and on camouflage. And Joanne, I was thrown out of the Boy Scouts when I was 11.
Why?
I can't even find my way into a woods, much less out of one. But what I discover in that summer is if you give me access to enough research materials, and if I care about my reader, I want my reader to be able to get so close to a bunny rabbit that the bunny rabbit doesn't know my reader is there until they're rubbing noses. If I'm serious and love my audience, I can write about anything. So I didn't ask what the magazine was about. And when I showed up at the office of the publisher, these days we would Google him. We would know exactly what he does.
Exactly.
But there was no Google in those days.
Right.
I had no idea of what kind of magazine he was the publisher of. And I walked in and he said, the magazine is called Circus. And I thought, okay, I don't really like elephants and clowns, but I can write about anything.
I love
Circus. If I care
Circus.
About the audience. Yeah.
Yeah,
and he said,
Circus
no,
great,
it's rock.
Great.
He said, it's a rock and roll magazine. So I reinvented the rock and roll magazine. And our second year we increased 211% in sales.
Wow.
And he went from being a man of modest means to a man of immodest means.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied like a Talmudic scholar, rock and roll, because I knew nothing about it. And that's how I got into rock and roll.
And now when you were the publicist for like Michael Jackson and Prince, was it before they were blown up or you were the one who actually blew them up?
In Michael's case, his career was solidly there. In fact, the Jacksons used to call every week asking me to work with them, and I would say no because I kept explaining to them. You could get a talking dog to say Michael Jackson on the phone, and any magazine editor anywhere in America would give you a cover in exchange for an interview. That's not what I do. I'm not interested. And then when I met the Jacksons called and said they were coming into New York and could I meet with them. Now, Joanne, I'm a nice Jewish boy. And it's true that I've learned most of my social mannerisms from guinea pigs and laboratory rats. But there's a saying I've heard ever since I was a child. And it's, if you want to be a mensch, you want to be a real man. If you have to say no to somebody, you say no to their face. So I went to the meeting with the Jacksons on a Saturday night. Saturdays and Sundays were my hardest working days of the week, at midnight at the Helmsley Palace on the second from the top floor with white doors with gilded doors.
Yep.
And I knocked on the door, and the minute the door opened 4 inches, I knew I had to say yes. There was something dark. There was a dark presence of some kind. Something evil was going on. Those four brothers that I saw lined up against the wall, they looked like they were out of a TDK tape ad. You know, those ads where a guy is sitting in a big easy chair and there's a fan blowing on him at 120 miles an hour and his hair is blown straight back and he's plastered against the seat. All four brothers, you could tell on the first glance, every single one of them looked like that. And these were four of the most honest, decent humans you'd ever met in your life. You could tell this from half a second. And some dark force was in the room blowing that wind. So the minute that door opened 4 inches, I knew I had to say yes. Because there was something, there was a crusade. And crusades are my business. I was taught when I first got into the music industry to read the three trade magazines from cover to cover every Monday morning when they first came out. So I did that. It was very good advice. And I read all the charts. And on the R&B chart, something very strange was happening. There was somebody I'd never heard of who was moving up on the charts, and then his album went platinum, and no one had ever heard of him. And I had no idea of who he was. And then I got a call from California saying, Earth, Wind & Fire's manager is very happy with the work you've been doing for them. Would you like to work with his new act? His name is Prince. And that was the artist I have been tracking on the R&B charts that nobody had ever heard of. So in Prince's case, I helped build him from 1981 to 1987. And those were the key years for Prince.
Yeah.
Those were the years that made Prince Prince. I had a competitor, and his sales pitch was, don't go with Howard Bloom. He's never gotten a magazine cover in his life. We have Mick Jagger, David Bowie, and Paul McCartney, and look at the number of covers we've gotten. What he wasn't saying is, these people were already cover material before we ever stepped into the case. We don't know how to build cover artists. We simply know how to sign them. So I felt that my job then was to take people nobody had ever heard of and make them cover material so I could give a big screw to my leading competitor. And that's what I did.
And you did. I was just going to say, you did. And you know what? I didn't realize you were at Gulf and Western. I think I may have actually corresponded with, I don't know, you or someone there for sure, because, and ABC, because I had an idea years ago, oh my God, and it was the 80s, and I needed to get permission to use one of Michael Jackson's songs, and I think I may have actually corresponded with you in the past, Howard, when I saw your bio here that you worked with, you were head of Gulf and Western. I think we may have corresponded years ago.
Well, it could be. We didn't have, the people who had Motown had Michael Jackson, and then Epic, a part of Columbia Records, had Michael Jackson. Yeah. And I was first at headed a PR department for an artist relations department for Gulf and Western, and then my department was moved over to ABC when ABC bought us, and I got a very peculiar call when ABC bought Gulf and Western's record holdings. They flew a vice president into New York City to say, "Go on about your business as usual. There will be no blood flowing in the corridors of this company." And I immediately knew there would be blood flowing in the corridors of the company. So I had my staff stop everything they were doing and figure out if all the space in magazines and newspapers and all the time on radio, all the time on television had been bought with advertising dollars, how much the company would have had to spend. And I discovered that for every dollar they spent on us, they got $11 worth of exposure back. And then it was a snowy winter in New York City, and in snowstorms, we New Yorkers do peculiar things and we'll double up in cabs. The cab driver picks you up, says, "Do you mind if I make a stop on 32nd Street and pick up another passenger?" And of course you say no, as a matter of politeness. So we picked up somebody from one of the major ad agencies, and I told him the story of what we had just discovered. For every dollar the company had spent on us, they'd gotten $11 back. And he said, no, 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 your calculations are off. And I thought, oh, yeah, it had to be too good to be true. Maybe it was $4 for every dollar they spent. And he said, no, no, no. You got what we call editorial space. We calculate in the advertising business that an inch of editorial space is worth as much as 5 inches of advertising space. So you didn't get $11 for the $1 they spent. You got $55 for the $1 they spent. And then the deal was concluded. ABC bought Gulf and Western's record holdings. They sent out 56 pink slips. They fired everybody who'd been in that room where the Blood in the Corridor speech was made, with the exception of me, and I resigned. Why? Because they were firing my staff. And at Circus, I had replaced two people for 2 years, and they had to get five people to replace me. And I never wanted to do that again. So I ran organizations from that point on. And if they were firing my staff, I needed to quit. So I got a call. First of all, they said, okay, well, they flew that vice president, the one who made the Blood in the Corridor speech, back into New York City. It felt like he was there 2 hours later. That's impossible. Had to be the next day. And he said, take out a blank piece of paper. So I took out a blank piece of paper. He said, write down your name at the top. I wrote down my name. He said, write down the names of the staff members you want to keep. I wrote down the staff member names. He said, now write in the salaries you want. And I gave us all a 20% raise, and we were now part of ABC, as an East Coast Public and Artist Relations Department, where we made a substantial difference. And one day, I got a call from the lawyer who had negotiated the deal for Gulf and Western, the deal with ABC. And he said, you know why we were able to sell that pissant little record company for so much money to ABC, don't you? Well, Joanne, that's not my side of things. I'm sorry. I confessed I had absolutely no idea. And he said, it was because of you. Now, I know that's not true. That can't possibly be true. And he said, look, who flew out to California and said that if you were fired, they would leave? The head of Sire Records at Seymour Stein, who discovered Madonna, and the head of Dot Records, which was the number three record company in Nashville, vying very hard to be number one. And they said that if you left, they would quit. They would find a way to leave. You kept your position because you were the one who doubled the value of that company. It was hard for me to believe.
No,
but apparently
it was obvious to me.
But as soon as I got to ABC, I discovered something, that there's an alarm bell in my gut that goes off when there's a potential superstar. And ABC had something that we had never had at Gulf and Western. They had a record at number three on the pop charts. And the group and all of its publicity materials made a point of the fact, in fact, it was the first point they made, that they were a democracy. Every member was equal to every other member. It was a mixed black and white group, and every member was equal. And so I went out to the airport to pick up the manager. I went out in a limousine to pick up the group's manager, because I knew that I would have him trapped in New York City traffic getting back into Manhattan. And I said, look, I know your group prides itself on its democracy, but if you allow me to take the lead singer and pull her to the head of the group and focus all the media attention on her, I guarantee you I will give you a sir. Now, Joanne, I had never said those words before in my life about anybody.
And I'm trying to think who it is, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the band was called Rufus. The song was called Tell Me Something Good, and the lead singer was named Chaka Khan. Yes.
I know.
And Chaka Khan would become so influential that another one of my artists, Prince, would end up working with her.
Yeah.
So, because she was iconic. And I helped establish that icon, partly because
tell
that alarm
me something
bell.
Good. Sorry,
Sorry. So that's it. I should probably make my call to California for the week. I've skipped my meeting of the Big Bang Tango Media Lab tonight. I better apologize to what's left of them, too. It's one of the four space groups that I run. But But so that's the story, basically.
Oh, my goodness, Howard. We went wow. We've only got like 5 minutes left here, and I really wanted to talk to you about so much more. I mean, your other books, Global Brain, for sure. And also, we got to let everybody know about the new book that came out, the author. The Einstein, Michael Jackson, and Me. Yeah,
right.
Duh.
Exactly.
So
that's the memoir about my rock and roll adventures.
Yeah.
And what I was and my answers to the things that I was hunting for. And Madonna's manager, the guy who managed both Madonna and Michael Jackson, Freddie DeMann, says I don't know, he said amazing things about it. He said that it was inspired and what was the word he used? Something along the lines of ecstatic. I mean, he wrote me an email after he read it and said, Howard, we have to have a 7-hour conversation. So
I was going to tell you, I want to speak to you at another time, just you and I, because, oh, my God, there's so much more. You are amazing. Oh, your life that you've led. Jeez. And what are you doing now? Are you retired now? Or
No,
just
are you kidding
retire?
Me? I'm running 4 space groups. I'm doing 15 projects at a time. Actually, it's 16 now, and that's a little bit too much for me. I'm best off with only 15. I'm finishing my 8th book, The Case of the Sexual Cosmos, Everything You Know About Nature is Wrong.
There you are.
Howard Bloom Institute. It's a year old.
Yeah.
Just to perpetuate my work after gone. And within that group, we have 2 major initiatives. One is to establish a new field called omnology, which is a discipline for the intellectually promiscuous. It's for those with an aspiration to omniscience.
My goodness.
So that what I've done, you know, with 12 different fields, with scholarly work in 12 different fields, is something you could do.
Because
it's only by spanning these fields that you see the big picture. And big picture thinking is absolutely essential to specialists. It tells them where to go next. It tells them what to look for next. And
I am
the
in
other
awe.
One,
I'm
well,
in
the
awe.
The other one is a project called Why Save Western Civilization.
My goodness.
And I'm putting that together. It's coming along painfully. I have Harry Hamlin is co-directing it. Harry Hamlin, if he doesn't quit on me because I just signed a Republican, which could happen, but Harry Hamlin is, he was voted the sexiest man alive in 1987 by People Magazine, and he's the founder of TAE Technologies, which is a fusion energy company, and he cares so deeply about this issue that it's ridiculous. And
really?
I signed, we have Governor David Patterson, who's a close friend, who is the former governor of New York State. I just brought in Robert Walker, who is the former head of the House Science Committee, but he is a Republican. He's brilliant. He's wonderful. But he is like Newt Gingrich's right-hand man.
They're Republican. You can say, but they're Republican.
Right. So I worked with – the trick is I don't know if Harry is – I'm ecumenical. I work gladly across barriers if we have a common goal to work on. I worked on a project with Newt Gingrich that made it into Time and Newsweek. And Newt Gingrich is indeed the right hand of the devil because he is in league with the man who I think poses the greatest threat to American democracy on the planet, Donald Trump. And Newt himself is an experience unlike any experience you've ever had in your life, even if you've been me and have met all kinds of amazing people, because Newt Gingrich is like a granite wall. I've never sat next to somebody who was like, and knee to knee, my left knee against his right knee, with somebody who is so totally a blank, who is so stone-like in my life. I never imagined that a person could be.
I never cared for him. I never cared for him, ever. Sorry.
Well, he knows his science. He knows his space. That's where we have a common interest, and I'll work with anybody who isn't a mass murderer.
No, I mean, I just, you know, I don't know him, but, you know, what I did know of him back in the day, I just, something about him, like
well,
you said, he's very
strong. If you met him in person, you would find him absolutely beyond the evil that you think you know.
Howard,
as I said,
you need to come back on the show because we need to talk. I don't know if you want to. I don't know if you want to hang out on the show again and maybe talk, get more cerebral with your other books and talk about politics or whatever you want to do.
Well, I do political commentary. I've been doing it since I was 16 years old, so that's what I do on Coast to Coast every week. 3.5 minutes of political commentary, which means packing at least an hour's worth of information into 3.5 minutes and making sure I try to tell you things you would never know if you didn't listen to me, if you didn't listen to my segment on the show. And that's apparently been successful because I was on the phone 3 days ago with two publicists, one of whom spent 20 years as an investigative reporter, I believe, at the LA Times, and who's very sophisticated, and so is his partner. And I explained that in 2000, Vladimir Putin had overseen a total rewrite of Russia's official military doctrine. And that military doctrine now, ever since then, every military exercise has included the use of nuclear weapons. Why?
Yeah.
Because the use of nuclear weapons is part of Vladimir Putin's military doctrine for Russia. And so we can expect to see what are called battlefield nukes used at some point in Ukraine. And in Putin's vocabulary, this is a de-escalation using a nuclear weapon. Why? Because if you're losing, it makes the other side retreat.
Right.
So
it's going to de-escalate everything. You're going to kill everybody.
Well, you could hear their jaws hanging on the other side of the phone. And they said, how did you find this out? Well, I do this every week. That's my job for Coast to Coast, and I love it because it allows me to dig into all sorts of things that I normally wouldn't take the time for.
Right. Well, my goodness. Well, I cannot thank you enough for joining me tonight. It was a pleasure hanging out with you and speaking with you. And again, there is so much I want to talk to you about. If there's ever a day you'd like to chat, just you and I mean, you know, off the air,
I'd definitely love to have
you back, too.
Well, we'll do it on the air. And we'll contact Eileen, and she will throw it into my schedule somehow, which isn't easy, to say the least. But it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you, everybody. My goodness, Howard Bloom. Check out his new book, Einstein, Michael Jackson and Me. And it's actually, the full name is Einstein, Michael Jackson and Me, A Search for Soul in the Power Pits of Rock and Roll. And that's just part of his life. I mean, my God, if you just listen to what we were just talking about, I want to talk to you about the global brain and all the, just everything. And my jaw is dropping, like you said. I mean, you've left me in a jaw drop because I'm in awe of the life you've had, and I just can't believe the amazing things you've done and how they've happened for you, and it's just crazy, and I loved every minute of it. Thank you.
Well, I did too, so I will see you again soon.
Yes,
and we'll,
please come back.
We'll dive into some other subjects.
And in the meantime, I'm going to look for that letter that I sent to Gulf and Western. I wonder if it was you. It's driving me crazy. And if not, I'm going to tell you whose name it was, and you're going to say, yep, I know who that is.
Right, I'm sure I will. Okay,
oh,
have a wonderful night and a wonderful week.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Everybody, Howard Bloom, check out the new book, Einstein, Michael Jackson and Me. I guess it's available everywhere online, of course. How about in Barnes & Noble?
Well, yes, the easiest thing is always to go to Amazon.
Yeah.
And order it online.
Yes, definitely. And how big of a book is it? Because if it's about your life, it's got to be huge.
Oh, this one is about, this one's only a small slice of my life, the rock and roll slice. And I think it's about 290 pages long or something like that. No, that's right. It's about 300 pages long. I had to cut 30,000 words, which is too bad.
Do you have any pics in there of you and the gang?
No pictures. I never allow pictures to be taken with my clients.
Yeah.
Because to me, the attention, I had signed on for a kamikaze mission, and the mission was all about them and not about me.
Right. Exactly. Wow. Oh, my goodness. Howard, thank you again so much for joining me. And, yes, I definitely having you back. I'm calling Eileen. We've got to do this again. Hopefully you can squeeze me in. I'd appreciate it.
Well, that would be terrific. Okay, so I look forward to talking to you again. And don't sit outdoors at rugby games in weather like we had today.
No, you make sure you get a car that has heated seats in it, and that's exactly what I did.
Right. Okay, let's talk soon.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Howard. Take care. Everybody, Howard Bloom, check out the book, Einstein, Michael Jackson, and Me, and oh, my goodness, we are going to have him back. Howard, thank you so much. Take care.
Thanks, Joanne. Have a good night.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. I read Circus Magazine. I read all Variety. I did everything, and I did everything that he said he did, too. It's crazy, and it's like I felt his life was so Forrest Gump. Everything that happened to him was just by happenstance, and it's just crazy and a genius. My God. I mean, we didn't even touch on – I mean, I know we spent a lot talking on the earlier part of the show about how smart he is and with his science background, and I wanted to talk about the his book, The Global Brain. I wanted to ask him if somebody asked him to write that or if he wrote it himself. Because that book alone, it's about, revolving around Islam and how the human touch, how much it means to people, obviously, you know, you need emotion, and they don't have that. I think that's, and it's a lot of things revolving around emotion in the brain. So I'm really into wondering about that. And I wish we could have talked more about his experiences working with these folks, Michael Jackson and Prince, Cyndi Lauper. I mean, all the height of the music in the 80s, he worked with all of the greats that were happening in the 80s at the time. My goodness. So what a great conversation. Fabulous. So, and I don't know what to end with, but I'm going to end with this since I'm going to go off the wall with something science fiction here for Howard. This is Doctor Who, and Howard Bloom, thank you so much again for joining me. He's the author of Einstein, Michael Jackson, and Me. Go check it out on Amazon, and also his other books. And I don't have anything scheduled for you guys for April yet. I do have the guests. I just have to lock in a few more dates, and I like to get them all at once. So I know I should do them one at a time. But anyway, yeah, we are booked up already, but I'm waiting to hear back from a couple of other people before I start doing what I need to do. So anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed the show tonight. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. If you guys want to go and check out the roster of what's coming up at NJPAC, go to njpac.org. Vic De Benedetto, the show was fabulous. He is so funny. If you get a chance to check that out, go check out the event calendar on njpac.org, and you'll love it. You'll love the venue. Really great. And here we go. Thanks so much, guys. Have a good night. Have a great week. I'm going to try and do a music mashup for March, maybe the 31st, depending on how that day goes. So, all right, we'll see you. Take care. Thanks so much for listening. Howard Bloom, what a pleasure. An absolute pleasure. Music royalty. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Shadows of faith. Thousands of hands and eyes reach skywards for an answer. the power of a Titan press and the defense of a blue haze that's generated by a damn machine. It's that liquid dense gas that will thin out the population, so order can be had by the invader. Who can match wit with an android? Doctor, an intergalactic health call. He has the solution, and he implements the prescription. All is set right. Thank you, Doctor Who.